Well, good morning. Welcome to another equipping hour of hot button issues. Today we're going to be talking about abortion, euthanasia, and capital punishment. And these certainly can be hot button issues, but let's open in a word of prayer. Dear Lord, you are the author of all life, and we worship you this morning and praise you. And Lord, we just thank you for your word and for truth. And we just pray that we'll be faithful to that today as we study. And we give you all the glory in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I think I know most of you here. My name is Jeff Connor. I'm a practicing physician in the Valley, as well as an elder at our church, and have had the privilege of speaking about issues related to medical ethics, abortion, and euthanasia, amongst other things, not only to our church, but also to, I've spoken at a few classes at Point Loma Nazarene University in San Diego, and so this is a topic of interest to me, not only just as a physician and a Christian, but just something that I think is very important for us to understand. So one of the events I've spoken at was Square One, which is actually something we've started, which is hosted by Proclaim Last, and it's sort of a forum, and I was one of the speakers at that, put together by Birth Choice, which Ruthie Van Hovel is the Director of Development for Birth Choice. I want to get that correct. And so she has spearheaded this effort for us to put together a forum to talk about abortion and different issues with that, that we piloted and Proclaim hosted. We did that at our church a couple months ago. We actually have one planned in November at Rancho Community Church, so hopefully that'll be well attended, and be in prayer for that. And Walt Combs, myself, Ruthie, and then also Jeanette, forget Jeanette's last name.
Chun. And a lawyer now.
And a lawyer is coming to speak too. Excellent. So a forum of people that have something to say about these issues and make sure that some accurate information is being discussed. So, well, as any hot button issue as we talk about this, I always, when I speak about abortion in an audience, I assume that there are people in that audience that have been touched by abortion at some point in their life, whether they've had an abortion, whether they're a guy who's had his child aborted, whether it's a parent who insisted their teenage daughter or daughter have an abortion, a grandparent that may have. So we recognize that there are people that could be hurting in these situations, so we want to extend as much grace and understanding as we discuss these topics, but we also don't want to shy away from them, and that's why we want to discuss this. But that's something always a good starting point for us to humble ourselves and recognize that this is a sensitive issue a lot of people may have experienced, and we need to be sensitive to that. So what I thought we'd talk about today is go over a little bit of the biblical overview of life and personhood, and then talk a little bit about a Christian defense of life, and then we'll talk about abortion, kind of some of the current debates going on in the abortion domain, addressing objections that we may hear that some people sometimes have a hard time responding to, and then talk a little bit about where the natural progression of our culture's view on abortion is probably heading. And then we'll also talk about euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide, and a few minutes at the end, Nathaniel's going to talk about capital punishment. So this may be an objection you hear. The Bible never mentions abortion, so therefore it's not something that we can either talk about, or the Bible doesn't speak out against it, so we really can't take a stand on that, which I would disagree with. And in fact, you'll see this posted and reposted maybe on social media or other people that say the Bible treats the unborn as possession. And they'll the Bible teaches that the unborn children are treated as property and not as human lives. And they largely get this from Exodus 21 through 25, which if you read, when men strive together and hurt a woman with child so that there is a miscarriage, and yet no harm follows, the one who hurt her shall be fined according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. If any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. And so they'll say, obviously, two men are in a quarrel. There's some type of physical altercation. This references that a woman that's pregnant gets hit. the baby, she miscarries, delivers an unborn child, and then all that the husband is required is just to exact a fine on who accidentally hit his wife. They're just fined. Therefore, that's more correlates with property and not human life. And it's more, then they'll say in this passage, if any harm that follows is only talking about the mother, then life for life, eye for eye. So that's a common view of this passage. So trying to understand this, sometimes we can get a little flat-footed and say, oh, wow, I don't know how to respond to that. Maybe that's what this passage says. But let's look elsewhere in a few other passages in the Bible that talk about the creation of humans. And in Genesis 1:27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created him. So one of our premises is that we are created in the image of God, which gives us intrinsic value. Job 31:15, did not he who made me in the womb make him? And did not one fashion us in the womb? Clearly, it seems to be that Job is conflating what's going on before someone's born with personhood, with life. And that seems to be what he's acknowledging in this section. And then Psalms 139:13-16, this is a little more familiar verse for people. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. Praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you. When I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. So clearly it seems the psalmist is talking about the breadth of life, the depth of life, and that we are formed before our personhood, who we are, is designed by God before we're even born. And another one, Psalm 22:10, on you was I cast from my birth, and from my mother's womb you have been my God. And then Jeremiah 1:5, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations. So then what about this Exodus passage? How do we deal with that? Well, that was the Revised Standard Version that I read for you, and it actually uses some translation of some words that it can be a little misleading. And a lot of scholars say that probably is not the best translation. This is the ESV translation of that same passage. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. So there's a great article, John Piper actually, this is a message, and he goes through this passage very clearly and it uses a lot of the original Hebrew references and talks about the clearly that's a complete misinterpretation of the passage to say that the unborn child is just treated like property. And it's very misleading. However, it's trotted out frequently by pro-choice advocates to say, well, see, the Bible treats the unborn as property, and that's just not true. That's not what that passage teaches. Because some of the terms, and I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so I won't go into the details of that, but some of the terms implies birth of the children. The same terms when the children come out of the woman implies like birth and is used similarly, and not specifically miscarriage. There's other terms used for that elsewhere in the Old Testament where a woman has a stillborn child and they use a different term for a dead fetus in that regard. And different words are used elsewhere for unformed substance of an unborn child or stillborn, like I said. And the word for child used for fully formed children. And also further, as was mentioned in the RSV version, further is added to the text, is not part of it, meaning further harm to the mother or to the child. So if there was an injury, actually implies to both mother and child. So if we read this passage, when men strive together, they're fighting, accidentally hit a pregnant woman, that her child comes out. It's actually what the Hebrew scholars say. It actually implies a live child, the child's born. And if there's no harm to the mother or the child does survives, then the husband still can have whoever hit her the fine for the being struck, but not related to the death of the child. And then, but if there is harm referring to mother or child, then the laws are life for life. Yes, sir.
I just understand that you're saying that you learned a pro-choice argument, referring back to this set of verses, would be that the unborn child is
Is a possession, is just like if somebody's animal or life or there, something gets stolen, then there's restitution or other Levitical laws about you know, if you accidentally kill somebody's ox, you know, that's one of the things, then or your animal, you have to pay for that. There's restitution. They're a paralleling all of that. So the unborn child is just like a possession. There's restitution for that, but you didn't actually murder or kill a life. And that's what their argument would be. So, but this is free. If you ever see this, I actually put the reference for the John Piper. It's a very readable article, and he goes through that. And these slides will be available online, but you can reference that for people if they march this argument out, because it doesn't really hold water. So, does that make sense? Any questions about that? So, what's the Christian response when we're talking about abortion? We're talking about life. How should we respond to this? You know, certainly, I think the attitude of some people is like, well, it's so controversial, we don't want to talk. Maybe we shouldn't talk about it. Maybe we're going to be afraid of hurting somebody's feelings. But I think we ultimately definitely have to be in defense of the unborn. And we have to recognize that the unborn are unique human beings created by God. This happens also to be another John Piper article that I came across. Proverbs 24:11-12. Rescue those who are being taken away to death. Hold back those who are stumbling to the slaughter. If you say, behold, we did not do this, does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not repay man according to his work? So Piper certainly makes the argument that as Christians, we should be advocates to defend the unborn. We should stand up and do that. And of course, we have to do that in love and compassion. And our attitude of how we do that is important. So number one, obviously, is compassion. When we're discussing this issue, I think, like I said, I think the default's always to assume when you're discussing this with somebody that they may have had an abortion. I think sometimes people that get real animated, real angry in defense of abortion, there's quite possibly they maybe have done that and they're trying to defend their prior actions, and we have to be sensitive to that. We were talking about the magnitude of the problem at our forum, and it was interesting because Jeanette Chun, who runs Birth Choice, Walt Combs, who's a practicing family physician, and I'm a urologist, you know, we frequently encounter patients that have had abortions or men that have had their children aborted, and it's just our impression is just the magnitude of the underlying psychological problems going on with people is huge, and it's really underestimated. And what's interesting is it's not studied. In the 1980s, during the Reagan administration, C. Everett Koop, the Surgeon General, basically said, he was asked, we need to study the effects of abortion on women and men, the psychological effects, and he said, we're not going to do it. And it's pretty much been systematically not studied. Numbers aren't kept for the number of abortions in many states. It's not tracked like other surgical procedures and other health issues. The impact that it has on people is not really studied. In fact, the American Psychological Association, American Psychiatric Association, has basically said there is no post-abortion syndrome. They basically say, because it doesn't exist, we're not going to study it. And so what happens is a lot of the psychological problems that people may encounter will just get diagnosed as depression, anxiety, other things, and it gets pushed aside. So it's because it's not really studied, because those organizations, along with the American Medical Association, believe that abortion is a right, it's okay, it's not immoral, therefore why would you study something that, you know, is okay? And it's being sort of complicit in that whole arena. So that's why people, if you read articles, they'll say, well, it really, there is no post-abortion syndrome, but it gets really pushed down. And when it's looked at a little more critically, and when you look at some of the studies, there is definitely psychological impact from that. And that's kind of our impression with seeing a lot of patients. Years ago, I would just keep track of it. We, of course, take medical histories when I see patients and found out how many pregnancies they've had, what the outcome of those pregnancies were, if they had, you know, children. That's just part of a medical history where they had abortions. And it was amazing to me because just about every woman I treated as a patient was on an antidepressant or some anti-anxiety medicine. Now, I'm not saying that is wrong, or that people shouldn't do that, as even as Christians, if there's anxiety and depression, that we may not need medicine from time to time to cope with that. However, it was amazing the correlation between that. And that just gave me a sense of compassion for what people are experiencing, and also kind of informs us what to do. I think also, though, my initial reaction was, well, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, so I'm just not going to talk about this subject. And as I expressed earlier, I think that's the wrong approach. We have to do this in compassion and love. And we need to talk about hope and redemption.
I know it says not study, but you mentioned studies. Are there studies that have been done? Not official government studies, but other private studies?
Yeah, there are some. But since so many studies are done based on diagnoses, you know, they'll talk about, well, there is no post-abortion syndrome, so therefore you can't really study it. But there are things done, and a lot of times the study data is contorted to say, well, look, you know, see, there is no impact of abortion on a woman afterwards, and so it hasn't been studied well. There, a lot of people feel there's enough data out there to show that it has a negative impact, but it's just it's not a high priority, or it's not something that's politically correct to study. Or a lot of times those studies that show a positive effect may get pushed down in the editorial boards of journals because they say, well, there's flaws with this, it's wrong, there's no such thing. Oh, you're mislooking at the data, and a lot of these studies may not even get published because of bias of the journals, the professional journals. But the message, the overall message is a message of hope and redemption. You know, I've said many times that, you know, our past sins many times are not repairable, but they're all redeemable. And we have to keep that. And that's the message that we have to preach to people. Ephesians 4, when talking about the message of Christ, Paul says, rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. And so we need to speak in truth and love. This is an interesting slide. What's interesting, this is a poll of and abortion attitudes that have changed in the United States, and now the numbers in 2018, more Americans feel abortion is morally wrong than morally okay, which is interesting, because for years everybody thought it was morally okay, and that seems to be changing. Interestingly, younger people, millennials, who get, you know, disparaged a lot in our culture for various reasons, actually have a higher view of pro-life stance than people my age and the in-betweens, which is sort of interesting. So younger people, I think, are saying, well, this just doesn't make sense. We know that this is probably an unborn human life. To kill it doesn't seem to make sense to us. So there are some changing attitudes, which I think we should be encouraged by. So what are some of the current debate issues? It revolves around personhood. A lot of the pro-choice advocates are acknowledging and conceding that, oh, it's a life, but it's not a real person. It doesn't have person status. And our Supreme Court decided in the 1970s with Roe v. Wade that the fetus does not have constitutional rights, therefore it's not really a constitutionally protected person till birth, and that's sort of where a lot of this is evolved from in our culture. And they'll even acknowledge it's a life, but it's a less valuable life, and the woman's right over her own body and her autonomy trumps the fetus's or baby's life. And that's where a lot of the defense of this is. Even though as science and as we understand the developing fetus and pain and all these different issues, it's more and more appearing to be a human. And when you see ultrasounds early on and see how early organs are formed, and I've talked in the past about how genetically unique a forming baby is. I mean, those things is we actually science just seems to point more and more to this is a human being. This is a real human being developing, not just a non-person that's a piece of tissue or evolving.
When would you say that this whole issue of personhood now, you know, because it starts out life, okay, we got to agree with science, that's it's life. So then they go to personhood. And when did that, I mean, I, you know, my mind's going, okay, what's the next thing? When they agree to figure out what personhood is,
yeah,
what's going to be their next thing? You know, but what, when did the personhood argument or whatever come into play?
Well, it's been happening over decades. I want to say a big proponent of it was Peter Singer at Harvard, a philosopher, you know, who, where he years ago even advocated for, you know, young children before they are self-aware, you know, that we could justify killing them. And I'll talk a little bit more about infanticide. But I think it's been changing, and since Roe v. Wade, that's just sort of been the perspective. Within professional philosophical circles, you know, this is something that's sort of been evolving. But this is why, as more and more, I think the pro-life advocates were so focused on, well, if we prove it's a life, then they'll change their mind. Well, okay, it seems like that's happened, that it's a human life. Well, now we just got to define person. Do you have any comments about that? Or?
Me and Jeff were talking about this, and I think the idea of what a person is and that human life has value because we are made in God's image, and that means that we are persons, and I think that's something that's well defined in terms of Christian ethics. So we're kind of, you know, in a lot of ways, Christian philosophers and ethicists are ahead of the game in this because personhood is a really important part of what it means to be a human from a Christian perspective.
So. Yeah, and here, this next slide, even some non-Christian philosophers acknowledge that there's some intrinsic value to human life, and like Nathaniel said, so a lot of philosophers have established that, and so there's a real conflict with what's going on in the culture and the constitutional right of a woman to have an abortion with what a lot of people view life. And where is the soul, you know, is a big question. You know, science can't fully answer that question. We're going to talk a little bit more next week when we talk about creation and evolution and different issues like that, is the idea of naturalism, meaning that there's, if we look to everything that occurs only has a naturalistic or, you know, a material explanation, it's a very limited worldview. Whereas Christians, of course, have more of a dualistic worldview. We understand that there's not only the physical world, but the immaterial world that God reigns over, and that those things coexist. And so this is actually a book, a collection of discussions at Biola. There's a link here on the website that talks about the soul and research in neurosciences and some interesting thing there. And of course, near-death experiences raises some interesting questions. People that are clinically, you know, die, their heart stops or whatever, and then they have these experiences that have a lot of similarities, interestingly, and they come back to life. And it's sort of like, well, that's how do you explain that from a pure neuroscience view? There's a neurosurgeon, I think it was a Johns Hopkins, I forget his name, who had a near-death experience himself. He was an agnostic and atheist, afterwards realized, okay, there is a God, and he became a Christian. He wrote a book about his experience because it was so powerful to him and what he experienced. So, this is something... This is an article about a little baby girl born in San Diego, actually. She was born 8.6 ounces, a half a pound. What normally would have, and at 22 weeks or something, I think. Yeah, 20 or 23 weeks, which technically a lot of people define viability at 24 weeks. And this little girl, and she lived in the neonatal intensive care unit for several months and was taken home just a couple months ago with her mom. And... Sabie, I think baby Sabie is her name. But the reason I show this is because often the arguments to promote abortion fall into four areas. It's called the SLED test. Dr. Schwartz is a professor of philosophy, and he wrote a book called The Moral Question of Abortion. And he said these are sort of where a lot of the proponents of abortion will define that. Well, it's small. It's so small, it's insignificant. Well, size really shouldn't determine if something is significant or not. And with this little baby that's about probably the weight of an apple, eight ounces, I mean, that's amazing to me. I think, you know, that's a petite filet. You know, usually our steaks are bigger than that. I mean, it's just it's just amazing. And then yet that's a distinct human life, you know, that she developed. Sorry. The apple sounds good. But the other L is level of development. Well, they're so undeveloped. The heart has, you know, they maybe don't have a heartbeat yet. Maybe they haven't fully formed this, you know, these certain organ systems. Therefore, it is justifiable for abortion. And so those fall apart too, because it still doesn't change intrinsically what it is. And also, and you think, well, 1 nanosecond before you see as a viable level of development is then it's a different entity. 1 nanosecond before that, it just doesn't make sense. Or environment, where it's at. It's inside the mom versus outside. If it's inside the mom, you know, late-term abortions are becoming more, in some states, are becoming legalized. And so inside the mom determines whether it can be killed, not outside. And so, you know, that falls apart when it gets examined. And then degree of dependency. Well, it's an infant that can't survive on its, I mean, a unborn child that can't survive on its own, and so therefore it's not a real life. It's like, well, I haven't met a newborn infant that can survive on its own once it's outside the mother, because they need care, obviously, and nurturing. So this is what he says, is a lot of the arguments start to fall apart because a lot of the discussion falls into these areas. So what are some of the other questions? Well, what about a woman's right to her own body? We hear about that. Yeah.
So I almost brought up that exact, I didn't know that that was a book and it was, you know, had an acronym and all that funny stuff. But I like that, using that as an argument by taking it completely out of the realm of newborns and infants. You know, mm-hmm. What if you take the smallest kid in your kindergarten class? Can you kill that kid because
exactly.
He's the smallest kid? What about degree of dependency, you know? We all are going to end up back in diapers at some point and be dependent on our children to take care of us again.
Change your example.
Yeah. Yeah, hey, wait a minute.
But it's true. I mean, like, you can completely extend it beyond children, and it just becomes absurd. It becomes an absurd argument as you take it away from a baby in the womb or even a newborn child and put it into the realm of something that we all deal with every day.
Yeah, and what you're just doing it.
Or parents or something.
Exactly. And people that do, you know, apologetics or arguments, you know, study logic and arguments and stuff, what they refer to as reductio ad absurdum, what you're saying, that you reduce it to the absurd. It's like, okay, what about size? And that's why I showed that little baby Savy. Okay, her size, 8.6 ounces, should be so small that it's not, or as small as kid in kindergarten, whatever. Those are absurdities, but it's the same rule that people are applying. So I appreciate that. So, a woman's right to her own body. So it's like, wow, well, our Supreme Court's decided that's true. But if we define that other individual as a life that has this, that we would view as the same human rights, then you have two humans. And as any ethical dilemmas, you have to discuss then, well, whose rights may be greater, or in what situations might you have to evaluate issues with either life. And we'll talk about a little bit about what about the woman's health. I'll talk about that, because there are some dilemmas that can come up legitimately with that. But sort of that basis that if this is a human, a person that's forming in the woman, then her rights don't supersede that other person's rights. And so this argument sort of falls apart too. Unfortunately, it's not falling apart in our Supreme Court. So what about cases of rape and incest? What about that? I mean, you'll hear that. They say, well, they're pro-life, even in the case of rape and incest, like it's a pejorative. I mean, that seems like a terrible thing. Well, one problem is it misunderstands our view of the unborn. Our view of the unborn is no matter how their life started or where the initiation was, they're still valuable. They're still God's creation. And so that doesn't change our position. But I think some people can weaken and say, well, yeah, okay, maybe in that situation, it'll be okay. Can anybody else see another flaw with a presumption, I should say, in this instance? Well, they should have an abortion because they were raped or a victim of incest.
Do you kill the child for the sin of the father?
Yeah, that's one.
Well, somehow God's not in charge of human life and occurrence. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it tells us in, I think it's like Isaiah 46, you know, God determines, you know, he predetermines the things that have not been done as well as things that have been done.
Yeah. Exactly. But there's also a presumption in this that somehow by the woman having an abortion, that's going to either erase the trauma of rape and incest or be better than, or the having the child is somehow going to be worse than just trying to erase the child. And it's just not, there's a false premise built into that.
Mm-hmm. That you're heaping more trauma onto more trauma, and so they actually end up worse than they were to begin with.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
And there are, and then some will say that there's studies showing that some women experience some relief after having an abortion too, and so you get mixed, at least in the immediate period. The longer term studies show that there's, you know, two different traumas, like you said. So it's something, though, that is presumptive, that somehow that you're going to erase the rape or incest. There was a, this was years ago, we were in Mexico. Our son was doing Ventana ministry down in Mexico, and we gave a young woman a ride up across the border. She'd been a student at Ventana, had gone, and she had finished her college degree and came back for a short-term missions project. So we met this young woman, just started chatting with her and getting to know her. She was adopted, And her birth mother, she was the product of rape. You know, her birth mom was raped, and then she chose to have the baby, give the baby up for adoption. And this young woman had an incredible life, neat Christian lady, you know, and doing ministry. And you're like, okay, so you're saying that her life isn't valuable because her mother was raped. And obviously there's a flaw in that logic. And there's obviously many examples of that too. So what about the health of the mother? We hear that, you know, and that's where a lot of these even late-term abortion laws are found. Well, it's for the health of the mother. We can't deny a woman an abortion for her own personal health. And there is actually very few instances, and this gets asked from time to time, very few instances where literally you have to make a decision for the life of the mother. One of them is an ectopic pregnancy, or a tubal pregnancy. And a tubal pregnancy, the embryo will implant in the fallopian tubes and will start to grow. And if left alone and just allowed to go, the mother will bleed to death and the baby will die. There is no, that's the outcome 100% of the time. So that can rupture, the woman can have significant bleeding, and the baby can never survive to full term. So that is a legitimate moral dilemma that even pro-life obstetricians recognize. They have to go remove that tubal pregnancy in order to save the mother's life, and there's no option. It's not like it can be re-implanted in the uterus or anything like that. At least that technology hasn't happened. So that's a legitimate moral dilemma, but you can't explain, or you can't extrapolate those legitimate ones for just abortion on demand or for a desire in any situation to have an abortion.
Why can't a specific set of dilemmas, as you call it, dilemmas be listed? These are the ones that I have to take to abort.
Yeah.
Why can't a specific set of those be branded and then put out proclamation as a guideline?
Yeah, well, I think for people that have an attitude that are pro-life, there are organizations. The Catholic Church is vocal about that. A lot of Christian ethicists do provide those sort of, you know, guidelines and those things for people. The other type of ectopic pregnancy is an intra-abdominal pregnancy, which is a really rare thing where actually the fetus develops outside the uterus in the abdomen, not in the fallopian tube, and that's also a little trickier to deal with. It's extremely rare. Sometimes those babies do live to viability, but it can have significant risk for the mother, but it doesn't require you to kill the fetus, you know, but when it's recognized, they can be pretty viable. I don't know who would put out those lists you're talking about. I think people that study it know where the dilemmas are and know, you know, the stances we can take on those issues. But for most people, I was just reading a British study. Like I said, in the United States, abortions track less and less. In the British study, less than 3% of abortions there are done because of a fetal abnormality or because of true maternal health issues. Most of them are just, 97% are just elective or just chosen to do so. But the other thing that comes up with that is you hear New York advocating for late-term abortions for the health of the mother. They're even including that psychological reason. So if a mother's really stressed about having a baby, technically she can go have her baby terminate, even late term. And the problem with that is they'll say, well, you're robbing the mother of the rights or whatever. It's like, but those conditions, even if there's cancer late in a pregnancy, if there's some medical condition requiring that the pregnancy needs to be ended, there's another alternative, and that's deliver the baby. And that happens all the time. There's medical conditions where, in fact, that little baby Sabi I showed you, the mother was having severe eclampsia, a pretty serious condition in pregnancy, and they said, we have to deliver your baby. But the choice was to deliver the baby and try to keep it alive, not kill the baby. I mean, those are two huge differences. It's like, so many times these medical indications for the health of the mother, you just deliver the baby either by C-section or induce a labor and hopefully try to save both. You know, I talk about the moral dilemma. You hear this, you know, there's three people on a life raft and there's only food for two, and you know, they're out in the ocean, they're not gonna be saved for 30 days, so they just don't have the food and water to survive. You know, who do you pick? You know, and you go through these moral dilemmas like, well, who do you choose to kill or throw overboard? It's like, well, the reality is if you were in that situation, you would all three try to survive as best you could. You wouldn't try to choose one to be killed. And that's the false moral dilemma that's presented with that. So the other, I want to mention this briefly. Sometimes people talk about, this is a little slight divergence about vaccines, and they'll talk about, well, aren't some vaccines made from aborted fetuses? And there's a little misinformation. I think Tom Haynes asked me at church a few weeks ago about this. And There were two cell lines from aborted fetuses in the 1960s, and they used lung tissue from two different fetuses. The fetuses were aborted, but they weren't for the purpose of harvesting tissue. They used some of the lung tissue to create two different cell lines. And then subsequent to that, there's two vaccines on the market, a hepatitis A and a rubella, that use those fetal cells for vaccines. So some people see this as a ethical and moral dilemma. A lot of it, Christian ethicists would say, well, using the cells from that dead fetus is not complicit in the act of abortion. And what happens is, if we were to try to extricate everything from our culture, whether it's knowledge or material things that were produced in some sinful or harmful way, it would be impossible. A lot of things in medicine were obtained, you know, unethically. So if we were to try to say, well, I'm not going to consume or do anything based on its origin, would be in a bit of a pickle, because some of that stuff just can't be traced and tracked. So this is a dilemma that comes up, and there's Christians that for good reasons just say, you know what, I can't participate in that, and that's an okay view. It's certainly not something I would criticize, but I think what happens is you'll hear, well, they're chopping up babies to make the vaccines. It's like, no, that's not how. They don't have to abort a baby to do the vaccine. These are cells that came from an aborted fetus, you know, 50 years ago, and these cells are still maintained in culture and used to produce the vaccine. So it's a little different. Same thing's been done in cancer cells. Cancerous tumors get removed from people, and those cells get used for different research. It's kind of the same concept, it's at least as far as cell cultures go. So anyway, that's a little side note there. This was the thing I was, I talk about the natural progression of when we devalue life and justify abortion. This is an article published in the Journal of Medical Ethics. So it's a peer-reviewed medical ethics journal, two Italian philosophers, and this is an abstract to their article, where they further outline, and I'll read it to you, post-birth abortion. So abortion is largely accepted even for reasons that do not have anything to do with the fetus's health. By showing that, one, both fetuses and newborns do not have the same moral status as actual persons, two, the fact that both are potential persons is morally irrelevant, and three, adoption is not always in the best interest of actual people, the authors argue that what we call afterbirth abortion, in parentheses, killing a newborn, should be permissible in all the cases where abortion is, including cases where the newborn is not disabled. So this is something published just, you know, it was in 2012, talking about justifying infanticide, essentially. And you don't, if most of the reasons to justify abortion, it is hard to then refute if somebody wants to kill an unborn or a born child, an infant, for a lot of the same reasons. It's hard to draw that line. And so this is what is scary, you know, the slippery slope, as we call it, this, and where we're justifying killing people. And that leads into our discussion of euthanasia a little bit too. Just going to spend a couple minutes on. Are you cold? Shelly turned on the air conditioner.
It was hot. It was 81.7.
Any questions about this so far?
Well, as you know, our daughter and son-in-law had Elias, and he's had mm-hmm. syndrome, and he's going to be 10 in November, dearly. And they did not know that they were going to have a Down syndrome child, but as Natalie started researching, she found that the doctors would often, if they determined that the child had Down syndrome, that you should abort it.
Mm-hmm.
And many times it was reported that women chose not to, and those babies were born, and they weren't.
Exactly,
they
yeah.
didn't have Down syndrome. But to have that kind of control
mm-hmm.
is just so tragic, to think that in our culture is acceptable. And just one other thought, I find it fascinating that when there's a pregnant woman, a homicide, they acknowledge mm-hmm. that it's two lives.
Yeah.
Isn't that convenient?
Yeah, it's interesting contradiction in our own laws.
Just a side on that, 95%, somewhere around 95% of the children that are identified with Down syndrome in the womb are aborted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think it was Finland a year or so ago proudly announced that we're going to eliminate Down syndrome from their culture. But they're not really going to eliminate it. They're just going to prevent any Down syndrome child making it, you know, to birth. Because there's still going to be that genetic anomaly happening in pregnancies. They're not preventing that from happening. But once they identify it, they abort them so that they don't...
It's the most identifiable situation.
Yeah.
You know. Well,
yeah, and some of the tests aren't 100%, like you mentioned. So, well, a little bit about euthanasia. What time is it? We've got a few minutes here. So euthanasia is the intentional killing by act or omission of a person whose life is felt to be not worth living. Some people say that voluntary euthanasia, that's competent persons that choose to kill themselves, versus involuntary euthanasia, where the person may lack competence. And of course, people of advocates of assisted suicide or physician-assisted suicide, we'll say, well, that's not euthanasia, but in reality, a lot of the underpinnings are the same. So the physician-assisted suicide is something that's popular or legal in some states. We'll go over that. So what is not euthanasia or not physician-assisted suicide and not killing? And this is when people struggle with medical dilemmas if they have somebody end of life. Things that we don't consider euthanasia, intentionally killing somebody, is stopping medically futile treatment. If you stop something that's just not working, and we even sometimes have to make those decisions about taking somebody off life support when they're no longer viably living, the machines. I mean, those are difficult things, but that's not euthanasia. It's allowing the natural course to take effect. Another thing that's not euthanasia is giving treatments aimed at relieving pain and other symptoms, even when the treatment may very occasionally carry some risk of shortening life. So painkillers, sedatives at the end of life, sometimes those can maybe affect breathing, can affect people's lives. And so that's not euthanasia. And there's always a dilemma. How do you keep somebody comfortable but not suppress their breathing or so much that they stop breathing and you kill them by their painkillers? And that's something that's a challenge. But it's also been, there's amazing advancements in palliative care, which is what we call, physicians that practice this, that are able, and you know, most of them are pro-life people usually because they have a real passion for people that are suffering in the end stages of life, for that to be done ethically and done well. And there's great ways where you can alleviate people's pain and suffering towards the end of life and not hasten it unnecessarily. And another that's not euthanasia is if a mentally competent person chooses to refuse treatment. They, by informed consent, say, I'm not going to do that life-saving treatment. That's not euthanasia. They're just choosing not to go through a treatment, and that's something different. So American Medical Association has not supported physician-assisted suicide. However, now there's a whole debate. They're kind of involved in what's called neutral engagement because there's people on either side of the issue talking about it or not. And so I sadly think that's probably going to drift towards euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide.
So with the physician-assisted suicide, what happens with health insurance issues? Do you know?
As far as what? Who pays for it, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, the good question. Medicare doesn't pay for it, but usually it can be pretty inexpensive, just a few inexpensive pills. They'll give a pain, like a sedative and barbiturates or a lot of that, and they'll kind of just basically overdose on a drug. Yeah. So, and then some, here's the problem. Some say, well, it's so expensive to keep them alive, it's actually cheaper to pay for some cheap pills and hasten what's already going to happen anyway. That's what advocates of physician-assisted suicide would say. So a little bit, Hippocrates was 4th to 5th century BC. This is the original Hippocratic Oath, and I just wanted to show this here. The original Hippocratic Oath is, I will give no deadly medicine to anyone if asked, nor suggest any such counsel. And in the like manner, I will not give a woman a pessary to produce abortion. So that's what Hippocrates, who was Greek, not Jew or Christian, realized natural moral law would indicate this is the appropriate thing to do. All that's gone from current Hippocratic Oaths in medical schools nowadays. Those things are gone. There's very few, maybe some faith-based medical schools that may have something that includes some of this, but most physicians don't take this type of oath anymore.
And what's the value today in the medical world of a Hippocratic Oath? Why is that still being promoted?
Well, I think everybody recognizes there's an ethical code that physicians should operate by, but everybody sort of adjusts that and has changed that. It's just not based on kind of what we would see as standards and absolutes that are timeless, that we would stand for. A lot of them change it. And it's, if you read some of them, it's kind of just very wishy-washy. I will help my patient to the best of my ability and whatever they want. Kind of, I mean, it's just really, really sort of vague and wishy-washy. These are states that have legal assisted, physician-assisted suicide. You can see California is one of those states. But Christian views on this, human life bears God's image. We are part of a community joined to each other. We are not autonomous because there's a lot of complex things. If people start advocating for physician-assisted suicide within communities or within families, families will feel guilty if they do or they, you know, or if they don't do it, or then patients who maybe say, well, I'm going to die, I'm such a burden to my family, let's just get this over with quickly. And so there's dynamics there that can really be problematic. And that's why I said there's great risk for people who feel pressured into accessing suicide or euthanasia. And if you got grandpa who's worth millions of dollars and he's, you know, slowly dying, you know, there might be family members that say, well, let's just kind of move this along, you know, let's get to that sooner. But so what are the issues in the debate? The idea of human value, who determines what our value is? John Stott's a Christian, well, he's deceased now, but these were what he outlined, a Christian ethicist. Or human value, fear, what if people fear and why they may want to attempt physician-assisted suicide or something like that. Their fear of uncontrollable or unbearable pain, fear of indignity, being in diapers, being, you know, hooked to tubes and things and being, you know, very undignified, and a fear of dependence on other people. Those are things that may drive people towards adopting or accepting assisted suicide and terminal illness as okay. And ultimately, autonomy. You know, we want to be in control of our own life and our own destiny. I mean, that really informs a lot of issues that we, our personal choices. We want to be in charge, and we forget who's really in charge is God. And so oftentimes people want that. And you'll see these stories that people that I want to go and get, you know, I want to control my death. I want to be the one that decides when I die. So I'm going to go, you know, get physician assisted suicide and do that. And so, that's what drives, unfortunately, a lot of these arguments.
Well, I feel like if you don't believe in God, then you would have no conviction to just accept his will, even when it might be a rough road.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I mean, it's just like our society, without acknowledging God, then you really would be driven by our society, which is about success and dignity and having it all together. And so, you know, being in diapers and all that kind of stuff, you could see how someone could go down that road.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and they may even have compassionate, you know, Christians may be you know, enticed by those arguments. Well, I'm going to heaven anyway, and I don't want to be a burden to my family, and it'll be financially this. So, yeah, maybe that is a good thing to do. Let me just take my own life and move things along. And so a lot of these are very subtle but dangerous arguments to be proponents of assisted suicide. And we have to be aware of the foundation of all those arguments.
If you just think about our Christian community, I mean, I won't go outside our church, but it's like, I feel like any of us would wash each other's feet and care for each other if we were suffering.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that is not necessarily the mentality in the world,
mm-hmm,
in general.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And we learn.
We know what God does through us.
Yeah.
And what we are called to do.
And we learn much.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And we learn much by experiencing suffering and observing suffering.
Yeah.
I mean, that we learn much about God and his infinite love through that process.
And compassion, and it develops all of that. Suffering does that.
So I was going to ask I'm just thinking about like hospice situations and when, mm-hmm, I've seen people put on like a morphine drip at a hospice. Is that, can you talk about that? Because is that physician-assisted suicide? When does it cross the line, or is that a hard call?
Yeah, it is a hard call,
yeah,
because I think the amount of, you know, that gets, those lines get blurred by healthcare professionals even. Well, we're not calling it a suicide. We're keeping your family member comfortable. So here's more morphine, here's, you know, to heavily sedate them. And I think that's, you're right. And I think there's sort of a, maybe once a family's consented to keeping the loved one comfortable and they're on a morphine drip or something like that, then the doctors and some of the healthcare professionals that may say, okay, it's okay, let's just keep that up, knowing that it could be suppressing breathing, knowing that it could be shutting down organ systems. I mean, I think that line is probably more blurred than we realize in some situations.
Or if somebody's brain, you know, they've not got oxygen to their brain mm-hmm. dead for all intents and purposes, or they'll be permanently vegetative, and then they can put them on a morphine drip to kind of shut the body down.
Yeah, yeah, and that would be an unethical, because if they're completely brain dead, why do they need morphine? You know, they're not perceiving pain, so they wouldn't need painkillers. Mm. You'd have to say, well, then what's the purpose of the morphine drip? Mm. And even if they're if they withdraw to pain, if you pinch them or something, and it's a reflex of a arm or something withdrawing from pain, that still doesn't indicate that the brain is sensing pain in the sense. And that's the purpose of morphine, is to so that you don't sense pain. Mm.
Interesting.
Do you want
to quote in the Bible that covers this real nicely? There's a way unto man that seems right. The end thereof is death.
Mm-hmm.
So all these options they have, that's the devil's side of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to share in the last 5 minutes about a connected topic, which is I'm talking about life.
Yeah,
thank you. Which is capital punishment. So... you know, this is obviously, we're talking about life, but life is valuable. And so as Christians, how do we think about capital punishment? And this issue, interestingly enough, came up this week as our Attorney General announced that at a federal level, they're going to start enforcing capital punishment and resuming capital punishment. It's been held up in the courts for a long time because they used a 3-drug cocktail, and there's all these lawsuits about that and how much of each drug to do. So it's not cruel and unusual punishment. And they're moving to a single drug cocktail so that it's going to be, it wouldn't be a cocktail. They're moving to a single drug, and they're going to start enforcing it. So how, as Christians, should we think about capital punishment? And there's three kind of main views that Christians take on this. First is rehabilitationism, that says that we should never have capital punishment for any crime. The second view is reconstructionism, that says capital punishment should happen for all major crimes. And the third one is retributionism, which says capital punishment should happen for capital crimes. And so let me just talk about each of those for a moment. So rehabilitationism says that the goal of punishment should be not to punish somebody, but to reform them, to help them change. Ezekiel 18:23, "Have I any pleasure in the death of the wicked, declares the Lord God, but and not rather that he should turn from his way and live." So the person who advocates this will say capital punishment was abolished with the Mosaic Law, and it's ruled out by love. If you really love somebody, how can you advocate for them to be put to death? So how can you deal with that? A couple of responses and thoughts about that. Genesis 9:6 is a very important verse when it deals with life. It says, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image." Now, that's an important verse for a number of reasons. For one, it's important because it's where it's placed in the Bible. So Genesis 9, it means that it's happened after the fall. So that means even as fallen humans, we still bear God's image. And we still have worth and value that's rooted in our bearing of God's image. So that's important. But also, not only is it after the fall, but it's before the Mosaic Law is given. So this isn't something that, Jesus fulfilled the law. Yes, completely he fulfilled it. But this shows a moral principle that is before the Mosaic Law and is not, you can't just throw out with the rest of the Mosaic Law if you think that Jesus, because Jesus fulfilled that. So that's rehabilitationism. Reconstructionism says we ought to take the Mosaic Law and reinstitute the Mosaic Law, except for not the ceremonial aspects of the law, but all of the moral aspects of the Mosaic Law. That shows us God's standard. God is unchanging, and so that's the standard we should seek to implement in our society and culture. It's the standard we should live by. This is a view that was popularized by a guy named Greg Bahnsen. And so he would say that we look at the Mosaic Law, we'll see that what people were executed for under Mosaic Law, and it should be the same thing in our law. So in the Mosaic Law, here's the list of, there's 23 things people were executed for. Murder, contemptuous act against a judge, causing a fatal miscarriage,
false testimony about a potential capital crime, negligence by the owner of an ox that kills people, idolatry, blasphemy, witchcraft, sorcery, false prophecy, apostasy, breaking the Sabbath, homosexual relationships, bestiality, adultery, rape, incest, cursing parents, rebellion by children, kidnapping, drunkenness by priests, unanointed individuals touching the holy furnishings in the temple, which ceremonial, striking parents, and having sex during a woman's menstrual period. So they would say those are things that capital punishment should be instituted for, because that's God's standard, that's his law, that's where we should go. The final view is retributionism. This says capital punishment should be given for capital crimes. So when somebody is killed, when somebody dies, and if somebody causes the death of another, that is when we should institute capital punishment. So back to that Genesis 9:6 verse, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. And so when you're dealing with this, the questions that you need to evaluate is really, what is the purpose of the punishment? Is the purpose of the punishment rehabilitation to help the person become better, or is it retributive? Are we punishing somebody because they deserve a penalty and justice demands that they would receive retribution for their action? So the retributive view would obviously say it's retribution. The rehabilitative view would say it's rehabilitation. And on the retributive view, we would say, listen, they would say criminals are not, it's not that they're sick, it's that they're sinful. And it's not that the offense is pathological that needs to be cured. It's a moral issue. And so they would say, we're treating people with dignity and respect by allowing the consequences of their actions to play out in their life. And so what is the purpose of punishment? The second question, what is the role of the Old Testament law today? Is the Old Testament law still binding on us today? Jesus said in Matthew 5:17, I have not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law. And so they'll say, well, this, and so I think that in my view, the law is for the church, but it's not to the church. So it's something that helps us to know who God is, understand his standards and character, but it also is not governing us. It was given for a specific time in history to govern the people of Israel under the in a theocratic nation of Israel at that time. And we're in a different era now under the new covenant. So, and finally, how do we uphold the value of human life? I think that's kind of the central question. The purpose, and just as Jeff has shared, the question we're asking, we ought to uphold the value of life. And if we hold people and say, life is valuable, and so if you take a life, you forfeit your own life. That itself can be a way of upholding human life. So anyway, we're out of time, but that's any quick questions about capital punishment. I know I was just flying through that. Okay, let's pray. Lord, thank you for your word that gives us clear guidelines and helps us to think through these issues. And Lord, I pray that you would help us to uphold the value of human life, because by doing that, Lord, we know that we're upholding people made in your image. And thank you that we have value because we are made in your image. And thank you, Lord, that you love us and have sent your son to die for us. It shows us how much value you place on us. And pray, Lord, that you'd help us to live in accordance with that. In Jesus' name, amen.